Russia is using Iranian-built drones to attack Ukraine. They also contain American parts that are disturbingly easy to obtain.
They certainly can be purchased on eBay, and in fact, they can be procured from e-waste material. A lot of those common parts are in washing machines and microwaves.
Also, the results are in. Once again, it was another bad year for the planet.
There's over 10 countries in Europe that it was the hottest year ever.
We take stock of where we're at in the effort to cool things down. I'm Marco Werman, and ancient Roman structures like the Colosseum and the Forum are still standing, while that parking garage down the street is crumbling. It's something about the concrete.
You could think of Roman concrete as, you know, a 100-piece jigsaw puzzle.
All that, and we check in with a Ukrainian soldier on the front lines. Today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Thanks for being with us. The mercury keeps on rising. Last year tied for the fifth hottest on record. And that's according to NASA. Other U.S. and European science agencies also released similar data this week, which means the planet is quickly getting closer to shooting past a key target to keep climate change in check. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler starts us off today looking at the global thermometer.
Last year was hot, but it could have been even hotter if it wasn't a La Niña year. NASA's Gavin Schmidt explains that weather system in the tropical Pacific typically cools things down a bit.
But this was, in fact, the warmest La Niña year in the whole record.
Europe's Copernicus Climate Change Service says 2022 was that continent's second hottest year ever. Here's Deputy Director Samantha Burgess.
Although it was the second hottest year for Europe as a region, there's over 10 countries in Europe that it was the hottest year ever.
Last year was about 2 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than the pre-industrial average. That's 1.1 or 1.2 degrees Celsius, which is what most scientists use. And the world is trying to avoid the average global temperature rising more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. That limit was written into the Paris Agreement back in 2015 after pressure from low-lying island nations. There's a backup limit of 2 degrees, but the lower goal has become the focus. Mohamed Nasheed, the former president of the Maldives, summed up why for me a couple of years ago. Passing that lower threshold, he says, poses an existential threat.
It means we're dead, just simply dead. A whole country gone, a whole people gone, a whole society gone, a whole community gone. And this is the case with many, many low-lying islands.
That target has always been wildly ambitious. But in the last 7 years, as carbon emissions have continued to rise, it's gotten even more so. Emissions need to be slashed 45% by the end of this decade to meet it. And many climate scientists will tell you they don't think that's going to happen.
I'm pessimistic for the 1.5.
That's Swiss climate scientist Thomas Stocker. He co-led a UN-backed science report on the physical basis of climate change in the years leading up to the Paris Agreement's creation.
We're not on the pathway to actually keep the warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius. We must be extremely lucky to hold temperature warming below 2 degrees.
I asked three scientists tracking global temperatures whether they thought the world would limit warming to 1.5 degrees.
Dramatic pause. There's an inertia in the climate system, in the carbon cycle.
That's Gavin Schmidt again, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies.
I think it's very challenging to stay below 1.5.
And here's Samantha Burgess again.
My expectation is that we will hit 1.5 degrees sometime in the 2030s.
I think it's very unlikely that we avoid overshooting that level of warming.
That was Zeke Hausfather with Berkeley Earth, an independent research group, also releasing its 2022 temperature data today. It's technically still possible to keep warming at 1.5 degrees, but it would require a massive shift away from coal, oil, and gas at a speed that is hard to imagine, and probably sucking carbon back out of the atmosphere, too, after overshooting a bit. Still, Hausfather thinks the goal itself has been useful.
Even if it's a target we don't hit, I feel like the fact that we are trying means we'll probably end up in a better place than if we were aiming higher.
He points out countries responsible for around 80% of emissions now have targets to reach net zero emissions by mid-century. That is based on science behind the 1.5 degree goal. Burgess agrees the target has been useful.
Because it holds political leaders accountable.
This target likely being out of reach isn't something scientists talk a lot about in public. Thomas Stocker says there's a concern doing so would stymie ambition. He argues it should actually motivate people to redouble efforts to keep warming below 2 degrees Celsius.
The consequence should be that under no circumstances will we lose the second target and make the same mistakes again.
Some scientists worry that the 1.5 degree limit has been framed as a kind of tipping point, a make or break goal. Samantha Burgess says it's not.
The reality is that every single fraction of a degree matters. 1.5 isn't a cliff edge where bad things will happen.
Keeping warming below 1.7 degrees, say, would be better than 1.8, 1.9, better than 2. Each tenth of a degree could cause more extreme rainfall, like what we're seeing in California right now, and worsen heat waves and droughts, hurricanes and rising seas threatening low-lying island nations. Leaders and activists in those vulnerable nations largely are not ready to talk about a post-1.5 world yet, at least to reporters. Here's former Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed again.
I can afford to think that 1.5 degrees is not attainable. That would be a death sentence on our countries and many low-lying islands and coastal regions.
In the meantime, this has been one of the hottest years on record and likely one of the coolest you'll experience from here on out. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Drones, unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs as they're known, have played a major role in Russia's assault on targets in Ukraine. Some UAVs armed with explosives are made in Iran. Inside each of those drones are electronic components, many of which come from the United States. The Biden administration has launched a task force to find out why that's happening and how to stop it. Dmitry Alperovich is chairman of Silverado Policy Accelerator, a Washington think tank, and he joins us for more on this. Dmitry, what was found in the Iranian drones, these UAVs, that started these concerns in the first place?
What they found is that up to 82% of the components in those drones are made by U.S. companies, anything from chips and other equipment that goes into the drones that control their flight and imagery that they take. And obviously that is very concerning, but the reality is most of those components are commercially available. For example, one of the key processors that was found in these drones that is made by an American chips company costs about $50 and can be purchased online very easily. And it's so small that you can literally smuggle hundreds of them in a backpack to Iran. So it's going to be very, very difficult to control the importation into Iran of these chips and other components.
Yeah, I was going to ask you whether it's been understood the actual trail of these parts from U.S. manufacturers to some assembly line in Iran that installed them in drones. But it sounds like you're saying it's not that hard.
It's not hard for Iran to import it, and obviously they have decades of experience in trying to evade sanctions for a variety of both military and civilian procurement processes. In the past, we've seen both Chinese and Taiwanese and European resellers selling U.S. components to Iran in violation of sanctions, so the same may be happening now.
So late last month, the Biden administration called for a full court press engaging the Departments of Defense, State, Justice, Commerce, and Treasury to work on this. With all that bureaucratic muscle, Dmitry, what can the U.S. accomplish? What's the end goal?
If you actually have a task force looking hard at the distributors, you can actually do quite a bit, particularly if you start prosecuting some of those companies, especially if they're in allied countries, and send a chilling signal across the world that if you're violating sanctions for either Iran or Russia, you're going to be in criminal prosecutorial danger and you'll be cut off from future business with the U.S.
Is there an implication here that the companies are collaborating with Iran?
No, certainly no one is accusing U.S. companies of intentionally selling to Iran or to Russia. The reality is that this is a very complex marketplace. And when you're talking about very small components that cost a few dozen dollars, it's really, really hard to trace the end recipient.
Are you saying it's just as possible that these parts could have been bought off eBay as they could have been bought directly from a company?
They certainly can be purchased on eBay. And in fact, they can be procured from e-waste material. A lot of those common parts are in washing machines and microwaves, and you can rip them out of those systems and put them into use in military equipment.
You know, given Russia's military and its claims of sophistication, you'd think Russia could build its own drones with its own electronic components. How did Russia wind up using Iranian drones?
They've really fallen behind on the development of UAVs. They're certainly trying to catch up. In fact, they've just struck an agreement with Iran to have a factory be based in Russia to produce those drones. Many of them will probably be done using Iranian components, at least initially, but nevertheless, they're trying to catch up quickly.
And then on the Iranian side, help us understand how they, with all the economic sanctions they're facing, not to mention overall shipping delays and problems with supply chains, how is Iran able to find everything it needs to build drones by the hundreds?
Again, they have decades of experience in evading sanctions, purchasing things on the black market. China has been helping them quite a bit in evading U.S.-based sanctions. And they've built a robust reverse engineering industry where they're taking Western components, they're figuring out what's in them, and trying to produce their own copies. They can do that with chips. Chips manufacturing is much more complex, but things like engines and aircraft parts, they've certainly been able to do that.
Dmitry Alperovich is chairman of Silverado Policy Accelerator. He was briefing us on the Iranian drones used by Russia's military, drones that contain U.S.-made electronic components. Dmitry, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
The Roman Colosseum has been standing for nearly 2,000 years. For decades, scientists have been trying to figure out how it's lasted so long. Now a new study has part of the answer. As the world's Anna Kusma reports, it's all about the concrete.
Part of the reason movies like Gladiator are so fun to watch, for me anyway, is that ancient buildings depicted, like Rome's famous Colosseum, they're still there. But how? How has Roman concrete lasted literally millennia, while modern concrete often falls apart in decades? Not such a simple question, says Roman concrete expert and engineer Phil Bruni.
It's just such a multifaceted material. It has lots of different ingredients. There are many types of Roman concrete. It's not like there's just one.
There's a lot of variability in the mixtures and the materials, which means there are tons of ways to understand why it's so good.
You could think of Roman concrete as, you know, a 100-piece jigsaw puzzle.
A study from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology reveals one small piece of the puzzle in the journal Science Advances. Researcher Admir Masic went to Italy, brought a piece of wall back to the lab, and took it apart to see if he could recreate it.
We are able to kind of mimic what the Romans did in the past.
His goal was to understand a fascinating property of Roman concrete, its ability to self-heal when cracked. His team focused on calcium deposits found in the concrete, known as lime lumps, because they come from limestone. He made his own. And his final product? He says it worked.
It turned out to be one of the best in the class of self-healing concretes currently available for use.
Masic says his new mixture is similar to other good ones on the market, but his Roman-inspired findings could help create a cheaper, more durable option. And we need it. Concrete production is terrible for the planet. It accounts for up to 8% of global carbon emissions that fuel climate change.
If you think of building our infrastructure that would last maybe 50% longer or 100% longer, you know, compared to what we have now, it would definitely have a huge impact on emissions.
Engineer Phil Bruni says on a deeper level, the Romans built differently. And we could use a little more of that mindset in how we build today.
They were building for eternity, and I think a lot of what we build is for ubiquity.
In other words, quality over quantity. The gladiator himself, Russell Crowe, couldn't agree more.
What we do in life echoes in eternity.
For the world, I'm Anna Kusmer.
Peru is still reeling from the former president's attempted power grab and the new president's effort to crack down on protests. We'll have the latest just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Wertman. You're with The World. The anti-government protests in Peru have now hit the tourist city of Cusco, the gateway to Machu Picchu. The unrest was sparked when former President Pedro Castillo was arrested for trying to dissolve Congress to avoid impeachment. At least 48 people have died in clashes. Now the new president, Dina Boluarte, is being investigated for homicide and genocide. The World's TB Saisea has more.
Monday was a sad day for the city of Juliaca in the south of Peru. 17 people were killed that day, the deadliest since the removal of former president Pedro Castillo. A crowd marched alongside the 17 coffins. Among the dead, a young medical student in his work uniform trying to help injured protesters, a street vendor who was passing by, and a police officer who was burned to death. Most of the protests have been happening in southern Peru, home to a historically neglected indigenous population. Miguel Hugo is the secretary of the National Coordinator for Human Rights in Peru. It's a massacre against the Aymara and Quechua people, he says.
Estamos en una situación de una violencia irracional.
The violence was irrational, Hugo says. The protesters were trying to block a local airport by throwing rocks, and some apparently were using homemade firearms.
Y le pedimos a la presidenta de la República.
Hugo says his group is demanding the resignation of President Boluarte and immediate elections to stop violence. But Boluarte has made it clear that she's not leaving. She said she can't grant some of the key protesters' demands, including earlier elections and the release of Castillo. But political scientist Will Freeman says she could have done a lot more to stop the violence.
She could have appointed a cabinet that included a much broader range of political actors. She could say, you know, I'm willing to resign unless Congress approves the elections for as soon as possible.
Boluarte moved elections forward to April of 2024. It's logistically possible to hold them at the end of this year, but Congress has refused.
People in Congress do not want to have earlier elections because they would lose their seats. And in Peru, there's no re-election permitted for Congress. So once you serve once, you're done.
Freeman says Boluarte seems to be closer and closer to the right-wing factions in Congress, and that's concerning.
Because what's happened is she's legitimated protesters' narrative that this was all an attempt all along to depose Castillo and put in place a much more right-wing government.
Peru's Minister of Interior compared the protesters with members of the terrorist group Sendero Luminoso, which was active in the 1980s. Human rights activist Miguel Juno says by doing that, the minister is threatening, denigrating, and discriminating against the protesters.
Es decir, los asusta, los denigra, los discrimina.
In the past 20 years, 166 people have died in protest, and so far, no one has been convicted. Will Freeman says access to justice in Peru remains limited, especially in the south of the country where these protests are flaring up.
So I think what we're seeing is the consequence of a police force that clearly has escaped from all control and is acting largely on its own accord and with totally disproportionate force against protesters and innocent bystanders.
He says this violence will continue to complicate the legitimacy of President Boluarte, however long her term ends up being. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
Nurses in New York reached a tentative agreement to end their strike today. In the UK, there's little sign of progress on the labor front, and there it's not just nurses walking off the job. Paramedics, teachers, train drivers, and civil servants are all planning to strike soon. The British government is trying to put an end to it with a new anti-strike bill. But as the world's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, that could make things a whole lot worse.
Motorists honked their horns to show their support for ambulance workers striking outside hospitals in England this week.
What do we want?
Respect and pay!
When do we want it? Now!
Paramedic Dave Robb was on the picket line in Birkenhead in the northwest of England yesterday.
I've been out on the picket line since 7 o'clock this morning. Bit cold and wet.
Robb has been working with the National Health Service in England for 36 years. He tells me he's proud of the work he does, but recently, he says, several of his colleagues have left the job.
Because they just could no longer tolerate the demand on them physically and mentally.
Robb says part of the strike action is to do with pay. But it's not all about money. It's also to do with patient safety, he says, which has been compromised because of a lack of government funding in the NHS. Andrew, a paramedic on the picket line of the northeastern town of Gateshead, tells me he's striking to try and save the NHS.
The only way I think we can make change is by fighting for ourselves, which is what we're doing today, and trying to avoid the collapse of the NHS, which could be coming sooner than we think, given what the pressures are like at the moment.
The British government has condemned the paramedics' action Business Secretary Grant Shapps said the walkouts this week could put patients' lives at risk. This is why the new anti-strike bill is essential, Shapps told the BBC.
I think it's perfectly reasonable to expect that if you have a heart attack or a stroke, you will still be able to get an ambulance. That's something that, you know, with the nurses, they did agree a national level of support. Unfortunately, the ambulance unions did not, and that's why we're introducing these minimum safety levels.
Ambulance workers say this isn't true. They say they've given a guarantee that all seriously ill patients will be attended to. Opposition lawmaker Angela Rayner says it's not the strikes that are endangering patients' lives.
My constituent, Bina, who waited over an hour for an ambulance, who died waiting for an ambulance, and that was not on a strike day. That is because of the disastrous chaos we have in the system under this Conservative government.
The new bill isn't just about having a basic level of service on strike days. Staff who refuse to work could be fired. Keith Ewing is Professor of Public Law at King's College London.
The other aspect is not only can workers be sacked, but the union can be sued for damages for losses which the employer has suffered as a result of the strike.
The bill must go through both Houses of Parliament, and even then, it's likely to be challenged in the courts. Ewing thinks it may never be made into law, but the bill's publication has soured relations between the government and the trade unions even further. And for many in Britain, it's a reminder of the days of Margaret Thatcher, the Conservative Prime Minister who battled fiercely with workers' unions in the 1980s, introducing a series of laws that greatly diminished them. Keith Ewing says this bill may just be a bit of a stunt.
So my sense is that really this is an attempt to reassure Conservative Party voters in some of the Conservative Party heartlands that the government is on the case, it's on their side.
Right now, the majority of the public appears to be broadly on the workers' side, in particular in the case of healthcare workers like Dave Robb.
People coming up on the streets, people bringing food and drinks and even pallets of wood for us to burn on the fires to keep us warm on the picket lines. It is absolutely overwhelming.
As the strikes drag on, that public support might wane, but the waves of strike action show no sign of coming to an end. Yesterday, 100,000 civil servants across more than 120 government departments said they plan to walk off the job on February 1st. And if they do, it'll be the biggest strike action by the British Civil Service in years. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
We'll be right back with more. You're listening to The World. The world-renowned Copenhagen restaurant Noma pioneered the trend of ultra-high-end, locally foraged cuisine. Now it's closing. Foodies say Noma's problems face the entire industry.
That's why I don't own a restaurant now, because I know the reality.
We'll hear more about that reality and the end of Noma ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Moscow has again shaken up its chain of military command in Ukraine. Just 3 months ago, the Kremlin appointed Sergei Surovikin, nicknamed General Armageddon, to head the war effort. Today, he's been pulled from the job, replaced by Army Chief of Staff Valery Gerasimov, a commander who's been previously blamed for failures in planning Moscow's invasion. Regardless of who is at the helm, the soldiers on the ground, both Russian and Ukrainians doing the actual fighting, they'll continue to confront the horrors of war. One of those soldiers is Ukrainian Corporal Andriy Shadrin. We've been checking in with him every few months since shortly after the start of the war. Corporal Shadrin is serving in Ukraine's Eastern Front in northern Donetsk. For security reasons, he can't be specific about exactly where. The 27-year-old medic has been deployed to the Donbas region a half dozen times since 2014. That's when Russia made its first incursion into Ukraine and illegally annexed Crimea. Shadrin's job is to repair or replace equipment destroyed in the war. And in recent weeks, he's been especially busy in Bakhmut, a town where he says Russians have created a living hell.
They just shell the city in an absolutely enormous amount of bombs, rockets, and artillery shells. The city is like absolutely destroyed.
I mean, in terms of morale, either for the military or for the rest of the country, what does a situation like Bakhmut tell you about the war?
The Russians didn't change their tactics. They didn't change the way the fight, but they got some tactical successes in region of Soledar City. I think everybody knows it. They've managed to get the reinforcements from their conscripts or imprisoned people of recruited by Wagner Group. And now they're trying to make their success bigger. But I think that that's everything that they can do for now is just to send more and more people. That's the only way they can reach at least some successes the nearest days. That's mostly what they do. Just send like hundreds of people to die in cold.
I mean, it has seemed more intense in recent months. Is that strategy of sending more soldiers, is that working for Russia from what you've seen?
They send 200 people forward. 190 of those people die. 10 people, they reach some success. They manage to capture Ukrainian trenches or force Ukrainian infantry to retreat. And that is recognized as a success for Russian command.
What has the arrival of winter meant for you and the others you're serving with?
It's cold here. It's freezingly cold. Speaking about the engineer units, like mine is, we have to do a lot of small job with our hands.
Yeah.
But it is the same for the enemy. I know. We're just doing the same job we did in summer, but just our hands are always, they always hurt from freezing. That's wow. All.
Yeah, so very cold hands. And one of your tasks is to help repair and replace equipment used in battle, right?
Yeah. Sometimes we do it under fire. Sometimes it's just everything is fine and calm around. That's a good day when everything is calm around. But we don't have much good days.
I mean, after nearly a year of fighting, what do Ukraine's army vehicles and its armored fleet look like right now?
Well, it's mostly the outdated U.S. and European armored systems such as M113, but we also have a bunch of the Soviet equipment. But if we get Bradleys, that will be like awesome to get a vehicle like that, to have one.
It sounds, though, like your work is just a job of constant maintenance of this hardware. You said that sometimes you have to do the repairs and replacements under fire. Describe those moments.
Well, it's like the frontline change or the weather conditions are a little bit inappropriate and you can be identified by the enemy. And they have some firepower that is able to reach you, whether it is like artillery or just the usual machine gun on an outpost, and you get shot by artillery or by a machine gun, then you look around, get the situation of how accurate the fire is, how close it is to you, if it is you were identified by the enemy or there are some allied groups of infantry were identified and the Russians are trying to get them with their firepower. And if, like, according to the information you get from how the enemy acts, you're, like, continuing the job or you just start to evacuate somewhere in a at least somehow safer place and wait until the fire ends.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds really crazy. You're basically on an assembly repair line and being attacked at the same time. How are you holding up under this intense pressure?
I don't know. It's just my job. I have to do it.
Yeah.
It's much easier than the guys from the infantry have anyway. I have to do it. I have to help them be effective.
Yeah. From what you've seen in the field, do Ukrainian soldiers have the weapons they need?
You can never get enough weapons. You have only like, you know, you're short on weapons or you're absolutely short on weapons. So at least we're doing good. We're doing like pretty good. We are having some success on the north in Lugansk region. And over here we've managed to chain a big group of Russian soldiers in a constant fight, so they're unable to maneuver anywhere else in Ukraine and strike there. So I think we're doing pretty good, but for sure we need more artillery, more tanks, more armed vehicles.
We keep hearing the determination of President Zelensky, his outreach to countries and governments around the world to stay in the fight, supporting your country. How much does his attitude of not backing down, continuing the fight to the end, not ceding any more inches of territory, how much does that keep you in the fight?
Well, President Zelensky is just a guy who is representing the will of Ukrainian nation. You know, we're a democratic country. So, and I think something like 90% of Ukrainian people, including the army and the civilians, they want to come back to the borders of 1991, get any available guarantees to make Russia unable to strike again and live in a calm and peaceful country for at least some amount of years until Russians strike again. So it is president representing the will of the nation. And the will of the army, of course, is a part of the nation.
Corporal Andrei Shadrin is a 27-year-old Ukrainian medic. He's been stationed in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region for much of the past year. He joined us today from a makeshift base in the Donetsk region. Thank you very much, Corporal.
You're always welcome.
The Consumer Product Safety Commission is considering restrictions on gas stoves. They release CO2, which contributes to climate change. They're also a source of indoor pollution linked to childhood asthma. But when word got out that a possible ban on gas stoves was in the works, chefs and home cooks across America started freaking out. Those old coiled electric ranges are notoriously bad for controlling temperature, and for purists, you don't have that flame, that fire under your pot. So what's the alternative? Well, something that's dominated kitchens in Europe and Asia, something I've been looking into myself, induction cooktops. Paul Hope evaluates appliances like induction cooktops for Consumer Reports and was previously a professional chef. Paul, induction is also electric, just a big leap forward from those old coil burners. What is the difference? How does induction work?
So induction works by generating an electromagnetic pulse that causes what we call resistive heating. In practical terms, what that means is cookware, pots and pans, heat directly as a result of these pulses. So they get hot much faster, which in your kitchen translates to things like really fast boil times and very steady simmering.
What makes induction a healthier and cleaner alternative to gas ranges?
So gas ranges really are the sort of dirtiest of the major options that people have. You know, in addition to obviously emitting pollutants like CO2, which are bad for climate change and the environment, much testing, including some testing performed by Consumer Reports, found that gas ranges produce nitrogen oxides as a byproduct. That's a class of compounds that are, as you mentioned, associated with childhood asthma, as well as the exacerbation of other respiratory illnesses.
So in Europe and Asia, it's interesting, induction cooktops have already been very popular for some time. Why is that?
The short answer is really necessity. I mean, in America, we have had an abundance of natural gas, and we obviously heat our homes with it, we cook with it, we heat our water with it. There really isn't an abundance of natural gas throughout most of Europe and Asia. As a result, they got very smart, and they developed forms of renewable electricity and moved over to induction because it really is the most efficient way to cook.
And as I think about all the restrictions that have been placed across Europe on energy, how energy intensive is an induction range?
An induction range is vastly more efficient than a gas range, somewhere in the ballpark of 3 times more efficient, in fact. So that doesn't necessarily mean that you will see, you know, a boil time that is 3 times faster, but in terms of actual energy expenditure, you're looking at about 2.5 to 3 times the efficiency of a gas range.
Are Europeans scratching their heads at U.S. resistance to induction?
I have to imagine that there is probably some confusion about it. And frankly, I think a lot of that confusion probably stems from the fact that they suspect that if more Americans were to try induction, they would really like it. Currently, about 35% of European kitchens use induction, whereas less than 5% of American households have an induction range or cooktop.
In India, induction is pretty popular, I understand, but a lot of consumers had to chuck out their old aluminum cookware and repurchase new cookware that would conduct the heat from the induction burners. How much has that full-scale conversion with all the new cookware been an inhibiting factor for induction cooking?
pretty routinely, people are surprised at just how much of what they already own will work with induction. So cast iron is a great example, enameled Dutch ovens, most stainless steel cookware, and in fact, even more and more cookware made from things like anodized aluminum are being built with induction-compatible bases. Mm. The fact is, chances are very good that a lot of the cookware you already own will work with induction. And if you're unsure, the easiest way to check that is to grab a magnet off your fridge and just hold it against any of the pots and pans you may have in your kitchen. If a magnet sticks to your pan, it will work on induction.
Paul Hope evaluates appliances like induction cooktops for Consumer Reports and used to be a professional chef. And of course, I'm guessing you're still a serious home cook, Paul.
I am.
Thanks very much for your time. Good to speak.
Thank you.
As long as we're in the kitchen, Noma in Copenhagen, Denmark has consistently topped the list of the world's best restaurants, but the owners delivered some bad news this week. Noma will be closing its doors for regular service in 2024. Head chef René Redzepi said operating at such a high level has, quote, long felt untenable. The world's Bianca Hillier looked into how the move could impact the fine dining industry worldwide.
Kim Mikola was a sous chef at Noma from 2012 to 2017. He understands Redzepi's description of the work as unsustainable, because he says, like in many elite industries, which he calls luxitarian, it's not easy being the best.
Luxitarian things demand a lot of work, and somebody always pays the whole bill.
Mikola described working at all fine dining restaurants, including Noma, as backbreaking. There are long hours and a lot of time spent handcrafting food. In that sense, he says Noma wasn't anything out of the ordinary.
Well, it wasn't the toughest kitchen I've ever been to in my life, that's for sure. 100% no.
Still, Noma has come under scrutiny for their treatment of foreign workers and not paying interns or stages. The New York Times reported this week that Noma began paying its interns in October, adding at least $50,000 to its monthly costs. And in 2015, Redzepi said he has been, quote, a bully for a large part of his career. Noma's team declined the world's interview request for this story. In a statement, Redzepi says Noma will turn into a food lab with pop-ups around the world. He says it will be a more sustainable workplace for the team. A Noma spokesperson declined to detail how they will make that happen. It's a challenge that isn't unique to Noma. Olivier Canteau has been in and out of kitchens his entire life.
I've been raised in a fine dining restaurant.
His parents ran a high-end restaurant in France while he was growing up. He started serving there at age 12 and got enough industry experience to know he didn't want to make a career out of it.
I know the reality, and even if I love this field, if I love the food, I don't like the way people are treated in restaurants.
Instead, Canteau is the director of Gastronomicom, a culinary school in France. Since the poor working conditions at fine dining restaurants has become part of the public discourse, he says some of his students seem less interested in going to work at those establishments. But some are still eager.
Because it's also a fantastic experience, and it's like art. So we will have always people that want to make some great movies, that want to write some great songs, even if it's a hard job.
The art of fine dining is highlighted in the 2022 horror movie, The Menu.
Welcome to Hawthorne. I'm Julian Slowick, and tonight it'll be our pleasure to feed you.
The film is set in an upscale restaurant where guests are served exquisitely prepared dishes plated with tweezers, a ubiquitous fine dining kitchen tool.
We have a compressed and pickled cucumber melon, milk snow, and charred lace. Enjoy.
In an interview with Thrillist, production designer Ethan Tobman said Noma helped inspire the film, which also presents head chef Slowick as an authoritarian leader running a tight ship.
Fifth course on order.
Yes, chef!
Though he sees some similarities, former Noma sous chef Mikola doesn't think the film is solely based on the Copenhagen business.
I think that's like very far-fetched.
It is a Hollywood movie that turns deadly, after all. But the real-life restaurant business was enough for Lisa Lind Dunbar to leave the industry after working across Denmark for 15 years.
Everything we've heard is how amazing all of these chefs are and what a difference they've done for the world. But the story that goes untold behind the dining room is the suffering, the abuse, and the exploitation.
Lynd Dunbar says NOMA has long set the precedent for restaurants around the world, including for how chefs treat their staff. She's hopeful this follow-the-leader mentality will continue with Red Zepi's new commitment to a fair workplace. Olivier Canto isn't too optimistic. He's seen the fine dining industry be resistant to change.
We have had a very famous chef who killed himself because of the pressure of the Michelin star, Bernard Loiseau. And still, everything went more or less the same way. So I'm not sure it will change everything.
Corey Mintz offers one solution, simplifying menus. He's the author of The Next Supper, The End of Restaurants as We Knew Them, and What Comes Next.
That era of we're making it all in-house, all the bread, all the pickles, every fermented sauce, it's only possible by taking advantage of the people working for you or charging $1,000 for dinner. So the middle ground is saying, you know what we do really well is these six things. We're going to outsource the bread and outsource the pickle.
Mintz says that would allow for an environment that's still upscale, but also offer staff a reasonable workday. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
When 22-year-old Mahsa Amini died in the custody of Iran's so-called morality police last September, it unleashed mass protests across the country. But they did not stop at the borders of Iran. Demonstrations calling for basic women's rights and freedom generally in Iran sprang up around the globe. In the Iranian diaspora community of Los Angeles, the heavy metal group, Tarantist, have added their artistic voices to the protests. Arash Rabari is the band's singer and bassist and joins us from his home in L.A. Arash, do you recall where you were and how you felt when the news of Mahsa Amini's death and the first protest in Iran began to capture the world's attention?
Well, every day in past few years that all these negative things that have been happening inside the country, every morning you wake up and you check the news, you check the social media, see what's going on in the world, what's going on in your home country, and you see that okay, another day, another, unfortunately, new negative thing is happening. So it wasn't a new thing. It wasn't any surprising thing. But this time, the people of the country, they were done with everything. You know, they couldn't stand it anymore. Everyone was so angry and mad and, you know, heartbroken of this continuous violations and brutality. And then actually, one night, a friend of mine was calling me and he was asking, okay, for tomorrow's rally in protest in Los Angeles, what should we do? What do you suggest? And I'm like, let's have a huge banner and write down on it that this is not a protest anymore. This is a revolution.
Mm. I mean, the track we were just hearing, it is called Revolution. Your band's name means bitten by a tarantula, Tarantist. Is composing music that is essentially protest music a new thing for Tarantist?
It's not a new thing. Yes, since the first day, our music was socio-political, with socially conscious material against all this craziness. And these days, fortunately, everyone is an activist now. So everyone is doing the protest music and artwork and everything. So we finally were able to manage drawing everyone's attention.
So based on what you said a moment ago, Arash, is it fair to say that this very public and widespread expression of frustration with life in Iran was just a matter of time and coming? And if so, why do you think it did not happen sooner?
That's a good question. I mean, because of the, you know, majority of that was because of the propaganda. People were still, some people were still hopeful that something good is going to happen. This occupying regime is going to correct themselves, it's gonna get better. But no, it was all negative advertisements and propaganda. These guys were not correctable. These guys were false and wrong at the first place by invading the country and replacing the condition, the good condition that it was existing before, prior to revolution of 1979.
And when you say these guys, you're referring to the clerics, the Ayatollahs?
Yes, the Ayatollahs, yes.
Well, one of your band's tunes, Tarantist Tunes, is called Bizaram Az Dine Shoma. That translates as, I have had enough of your religion. Bizaram Az Dine Shoma. I have had enough of your religion. Who are you speaking to, Arash, when you say your religion? And how do you describe that religion?
Well, yeah, first, this is one of the slogans, one of the things that people are chanting in the protests. So I was just turning it into the song and, you know, adding electric guitars and heavy riffs behind it. But this is imposed religion that is, you know, currently going on inside the country, which is wrong. It's not religion, to be honest. Religion, it shouldn't be like that. It is all about peace and humanity and beautiful things and love. But these guys, the mullahs or whatever, they all talk about brutality and killing the people. And God wants you to be killed in this way. The prophet wants you to be killed in the other way. These are wrong. These are nonsense. These are false.
I mean, that must be such a potent slogan on the streets of Iran to say that your religion, your cleric's religion, is bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people are tired of it. People are, you know, they are so sick and tired of all this.
I mean, there's obviously a certain freedom and luxury that you have to write and sing from your base in California. What's your sense of how your music is being consumed and heard back home?
Fortunately, it's been getting heard a lot recently. So through all the social media and like the other media's TV stations, radios, websites, everywhere. And not only our band, a lot of other new musics are being created every day, artworks and everything. And people are very involved.
That journey since September, anyway, has included 10 songs from you and your band Tarantist, all inspired by the current political climate in Iran. How hopeful are you that the tide will eventually turn and that there will be more freedom in Iran?
Eventually, at some time, very soon, it is going to happen. Because, like I keep saying it, people in their mind and in their thoughts and beliefs, they already got separated from all these false things that the government tried to, you know, imposed to their minds. So sometime very soon it's going to happen. The page is going to turn.
Well, Arash, we're going to sign off with one of your songs that addresses that hope you just expressed. It's called Kabutar-i-Azad, or Free Pigeon. Just briefly, what is the symbolism of a pigeon?
Well, we dedicated that song to the beautiful souls that were killed during this new movement that started with death of Mahsa Amini. Later on, Nikash Akarmi, and so many other beautiful young boys and girls that got killed and executed. It's just dedicated to their beautiful souls.
Arash Rabari, originally from Iran, singer and bassist of the Los Angeles-based heavy metal band Tarantist. Thanks very much for being with us. Great to meet you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
گلوی هر فریاد نترس از این توفان در این شب بیداد بگیر دستم را که جاده باریک است بمان کنار من که صبح نزدیک است اگر که در شبها صدای شلیک است اگر مسیر عشق
New music there from the LA-based band Tarantist. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and as always, thanks for listening.